All right, we're here with Fletcher Prouty, and it is now May 6, 1989, beginning a series of questions regarding his book published in 1973 by Prentice Hall called The Secret Team. One of the most essential parts of post-World War II American political action and agendas seemed to hinge on events that happened immediately after World War II. With the passage of the National Security Act of 1947, why don't you discuss the original intent of Congress of the role of the CIA as specified in this law?
It's very important in trying to discuss the National Security Act of 1947 to be sure that we go back into the spirit and the thinking of the time. We had just ended the greatest world war ever fought in late 1945, with the surrender of the Japanese on September 2nd, 1945. During early in 1946, President Truman abolished the OSS. There was no longer a need for an operating organization of that type now that the war was over. But there were assets of the OSS, primarily such things as agents, agents lists, who the agents worked with, and other activities like that that you just can't abandon. They have to be taken care of. And these were placed in an office which was concealed in the State Department for quite a while. And also, President Truman, by presidential directive, created the National Intelligence Group and placed it under General Vandenberg, Army officer, but later the Chief of Staff of the Air Force, who had a considerable experience with intelligence matters. Both of these acts by President Truman were more or less standby. He knew that there would have to be some change in the law to act on these intelligence matters. At that time also, you'll remember that the Soviet Union had been our ally during the war, was not a stated enemy, as it became very shortly after that. So that the National Security Act of 1947, written, the language of the law, written during 1946, was based pretty much on the reality of World War II and not upon the Cold War realities. Now, for those of us looking back, that's kind of hard to think about because we have so ingrained in us now the fact that the Soviet Union is the enemy, communism is the enemy, and that the Germans and the Japanese and the Italians, who were our enemy in World War II, are all now friends. So you must go back into that era and begin there when you talk about the origins of CIA and the passage of this very important law, the National Security Act of 1947. Because I was teaching a major course, a year-long course at Yale called The Evolution of Warfare, I was very interested, of necessity interested, in these activities of 1946 and 47 as part of my course. So I read everything I could get from the congressional hearings, from the newspapers, everything that was going in those years toward the creation of this law, this new law. What you could see was some rather practical things, and then you could see some indications of things that were going to come. First of all, the Army and Navy had to share their aviation interests with a new branch of the service, the Air Force. That was one of the things that the public recognized about this new law. We created then a single Department of Defense. We hadn't had one. And many of the many of the officers that had fought World War II did not like this term Department of Defense. There's a very basic distinction, especially in warfare, but in athletics, in sports, in competition, between being on the offense and being on the defense. On the offense, you know what you're doing. On the offense, you're planning something. If you're on the offense with a Department of War, as we used to have, it doesn't mean you're planning to fight, but it means you're ready to fight, and you let everybody know that. If you're on the Department of Defense, You're waiting for somebody else to make a move, and then you react. The philosophy of the entire military structure of this country changed with this business of the Department of Defense. And coming as it did right when we were the most powerful nation in the world, with an enormous army, navy, and air force, and the nuclear weapon, which nobody else had in that period, to put all of that on the defense was an enormous oversight. And those of us who were close to all that felt it that way. There was no way to say that the World War II armies of the United States were to go on the defense. That destroyed, really, the structure of the Army, and a lot of people on active service felt that at that time. I say that because this business of the communist, anti-communist bit, and the idea of a Department of War or Department of Navy as against Department of Defense, another major thing, was then joined by this new idea of a central intelligence agency. Now, one of the problems during World War II was not that we did not have enough intelligence. It was that it wasn't coordinated. The intelligence that General MacArthur and Admiral Nimitz had in the Pacific was not always coordinated with the intelligence that General Eisenhower and General Bradley and their allies had in the European theater. And a lot of times, Washington had different intelligence from different sources and didn't have the means to coordinate it properly for the overall benefit of our military forces who are fighting all over the world. And we had new ways of gathering intelligence. We had new electronic means. Radar was used to gather intelligence. We had aerial photography. We had all kinds of devices that were not in the ordinary James Bond intelligence of pre-war days. So the Congress understood from a lot of testimony from experienced military leaders that one of the greatest shortages and one of the greatest mistakes in the war was that we did not have coordinated intelligence. So when Congress wrote the language of this legislation for the CIA, and I printed this literally in the book so that anyone that wants to read it will see exactly what the law says. It said that the CIA is created to coordinate the intelligence of the rest of the government, and that was why it was created. With that as the primary duty of CIA, then the other little tasks and things that we're supposed to do come forward. Mm-hmm. And it's a better explanation. In fact, it is the only explanation when it is put that way. There was not a single word, for example, in the law that said that the CIA should collect intelligence. There wasn't a single word in the law that said the CIA should get involved in covert operations. And this is the same law that exists today, by the way. We haven't changed. But gradually things change, whether they're written into the law or not. But we're talking about the law of 1947, how it was written and what it meant, so that the people that first became members of this new CIA knew that their job was the coordination of intelligence. They had no doubt. The enormous move toward Cold War, anti-communism, and all that, all the buzzwords that we've lived on for the last 30 or 40 years, did not exist there, at least not strongly. It was coming over the horizon. While the National Security Act of 1947 was being written, primarily by men like the great lawyer Clark Clifford, close friend of President Truman's, and an enormously influential man in this period, while that was being done, Churchill had made his speech in Missouri about the Iron Curtain and the Cold War and those things. The country was beginning to move in that direction. The era, the strange McCarthy era, had not come, but it was inevitable. It was on the way. What to do with the nuclear weapons was underway at the time. For instance, our military had never had a weapon as dynamic as the atom bomb. And what is important about an atom bomb, as it is with a barrel of oil, is it has no real value until it's been delivered. Well, the organization most able to deliver the atom bomb was the Air Force. And immediately, war planners saw that to use atom bombs, we would have to have an enormous fleet of very large aircraft. And one of the first thing they did was began to build a bigger and better B-29, which was the largest plane we had during the war, and finally even the B-36 and then the B-52 to carry the atom bomb. They needed an enormous plane to do that. It was a monster of a device in those days. Well, these things began to shape strategy. Then as they began to think about this, if atom bombs were going to be used as the primary weapon, how were you going to put a navy and an army into the battleground that atom bombs had devastated or could devastate, either way, because the enemy didn't have it. See, the enemy then, it used to be interesting. If you went to a military school in the 40s, you could talk about an enemy, but we were a Department of Defense. We weren't supposed to be talking about a particular enemy. And gradually, enemy became synonymous with Russia. And if we had opposing forces in a combat situation, we'd have the blue forces and the red forces. And we always knew we were the blue ones and that the Soviet. Gradually, this thinking came about. So while we were predominant with the nuclear weapon, it almost was ridiculous to think of any country as equal opposite force to ours. And that furthermore underscored the enormous mistake made in calling this military the Department of Defense, because if ever we were strong on the offense, it was immediately after World War II. We weren't a defensive nation at that time, but we were made a defensive nation by the Department of Defense. It's I haven't heard many people discuss that in so many words. I did in Yale when I was teaching. I used to talk about that a lot because I had hoped that was not really what was going to be the end of all this planning. Well, as the CIA started late in 47, it was primarily a rollover of World War II trained military people. The head of it was an admiral, Admiral Hillenkoetter. Mm-hmm. And I think out of the number that they had, over 5,000 were directly serving military people. They weren't reservists or anything. They were active duty people. And gradually, people from OSS and new recruitment began to fill up the agency. But that took years. That got into the Dulles era, Alan Dulles era, in the Eisenhower administration. During the late 40s, the number of civilians that rolled into the agency gradually was a relatively small number. I say relatively small with respect to, say, today. And among them, though, were some very strong OSS residual members who were well-trained in the side of covert work that involves clandestine operations. And despite the fact that was totally overlooked in the law, even so much as to suppress that kind of activity by not putting it in the law and not creating a budget basis for that kind of expenditure of funds, the people with that training came into the CIA. Certainly the military wasn't going to get into that business, nor was the State Department. So it was a question of where do you keep this? So the residual OSS capability fell into the lap of the CIA. But even then, that took years. That didn't happen until General Walter Beadle Smith came home from Russia, where he had been ambassador to Russia, and became the director of Central Intelligence in, I believe, about 1950.
October of 1950.
And at that time, he brought Alan Dulles in as his deputy director of plans, which means in charge of covert operations. Well, Dulles had been with the OSS. And then he announced to the president that if he was going to be in charge, if he was going to be the director of Central Intelligence, he was going to have OPC under him and not scattered around with responsibilities in the State Department and the Defense Department. A lot has been said about OPC in the sense that how could such an organization have been created without law, and how was this ingenious little device of appointing its senior officer The way it read was that he would be nominated by one secretary, either state or defense, and having to be seconded by the other, and then would be approved, and as though he didn't have a single commander. Well, everybody knew that was temporary, and it had no real significance, because the real things that OPC was doing was to preserve certain assets, certain highly classified assets of World War II. He was not initiating operations. Now, I don't mean to say that disregarding some of the very practical things that were being done. For instance, we had clandestine operations underway in Greece as a result of the Greek Civil War right after the World War II, and these spilled over into Bulgaria and nearby countries across the Greek border. We had other operations going on in China, but relatively speaking, they were small, and they were, again, residuals of World War II. They were not planned operations as against some communist nation or that kind of thing. They were there, but they existed, and this was there. And the chief of OPC at the time was Frank Wisner, who had been a very dominant OSS leader in Eastern Europe during World War II, and later who led this massive campaign against Indonesia in 1958. So Wisner was very active in the covert activities. But when General Smith became the DCI, he insisted upon bringing that group into the agency. Now, strictly speaking, that was not supported by law. Uh-huh. It was sort of an expedient. One of the most important facets of this National Security Act of 1947 was the creation of the National Security Council. We had not had something like that in peacetime in other years, not under Roosevelt and not before, and I don't even recall anything like that in World War I period. What was decided was that there are times when, for purposes of national security, there must be top-level decisions, and that the president needed assistance in making those decisions. So the National Security Council, by law, is the president, the vice president, the secretary of state, and the secretary of defense. No others. They can invite others, and others do attend the meetings, but there are no other statutory members. If we relate that to today's affairs, in all these questions about the Iran and Contra hearings and all those problems, there could not have been a decision about covert operations involving the Contras or Iran or exchange of hostages or any of that without a decision from the National Security Council. That's by law. There's no other way to do it other than an illegal way, and I don't think that's ever even been assumed, that there had to be decisions from the National Security Council. From my own experience and background, I just cannot believe that the members of the National Security Council during this Iran-Contra period have removed themselves from the whole thing as though they had nothing to do with it. That's preposterous. By law, they had to. If they didn't do it, they were derelict in their duty, and they should be tried for that. That's what the National Security Council was created to do. And in the 40s, the National Security Council met and created a directive which I believe is called 10/2. And 10/2 recognized that the U.S. government might from time to time be involved or involve itself in covert action. Generally, this would mean relatively small activities, not major warfare like the Korean War or the Vietnam War, that kind of thing, not even like the invasion of Cuba at the Bay of Pigs. These were truly clandestine covert actions, and there were many of them, many of them. But later on, when I got into this business in the 50s, we had things like that going all the time, but they were small. Now, the decision to involve the United States in covert action had to be made by this National Security Council. No one else. No one else had the authority. And you see, that means even that the DCI, the head of the intelligence agency, was not part of the National Security Council. Therefore, he was not involved in the decision. He would be told about the decision. Well, during the 40s and the early 50s, things worked that way. In 1948, a rather important thing happened. President Truman wanted to have a highly qualified group study how the CIA was moving along, how it was progressing, and whether or not it was becoming effective. So he established a committee headed by Alan Dulles, who was a New York lawyer with the most prominent and largest law firm in New York City, Sullivan Cromwell, a man named Matthias Correa, who I believe also was a lawyer, although I don't recall his career that closely. His name, Correa, C-O-R-R-E-A, Matthias Correa, and then a man named Jackson. Jackson had a lot of experience, OSS experience. I think Correa did, and I certainly know that Dulles did. But anyway, this committee of three men, primarily Alan Dulles, made an extensive study of the activities of the CIA, and in their report to the president, recommended a move more into the clandestine operations area and more into the traditional intelligence area than the law had even visualized. Well, a very interesting thing about this committee, it was appointed by President Truman in his final year as president, as a successor to Roosevelt. See, Roosevelt died in 45 and he was the vice president, so he hadn't won an election yet, and he was going to run for re-election late 48 and then a new term beginning in 49. His opponent was Thomas E. Dewey. And interestingly, Thomas Dewey's speechwriter during the 1948 campaign against Truman was Alan Dulles. So you see, Dulles was riding two horses across this stream. He was technically Truman's advisor with respect to intelligence matters, he and Jackson and Correa. At the same time, he's writing speeches for Thomas E. Dewey, strongly opposing the re-election of Truman. I don't know whether Truman knew he was writing speeches for Dewey or whether Dewey knew he was working for Truman. I mean, I have no way to solve that little problem. But it's pretty neat to understand the effect of that, and it helps you understand the mind of this man Dulles. Dulles see nothing wrong in that sort of thing, you see. See nothing wrong in working for Truman and trying to undercut him by helping Dewey or vice versa. Well, this had an influence on the report because, of course, Dulles, as was Jackson and Correa, were absolutely convinced, along with most of the country, that Dewey was going to be elected president. So as he wrote this report, he saw that report as, you might say, his own Mein Kampf. It was his own idea of what CIA was going to become, because he was positive that Dewey would make him the director of Central Intelligence when Dewey became president. See, and that designed the report. Well, as we know, Truman turned around and beat Dewey in a great surprise. And without much ado, the Dulles, Jackson, and Correa report was slid under the White House door on the 1st of January 1949, and we never heard much of it after that. Although many of the things within the report did appear years later, because when Eisenhower became president, John Foster Dulles became Secretary of State, General Walter Beadle Smith became his deputy in the Secretary of State, stepped down from CIA, and Alan Dulles became the Director of Central Intelligence. Well, at that time, Dulles pulled out his own Dulles-Jackson-Correa report and began to put it in effect, and as you know, he remained the DCI for the next 11 years. Really, the signal primary character of the CIA is Mr. Dulles. There's no question about it. It's his agency, and nobody else has left any mark like his. But you need to see that background to understand what the passage of the National Security Act really meant in 1947, and what it says in law is what creates many of these controversies about intelligence today, because there still is no law that says that the CIA is an intelligence organization. It says it's a coordinating agent, and there's no law that says it is a covert operation agency. So that's a fairly good summary, as I've seen it through my own lifetime, of the law itself, the effect of the law, and then particularly how the CIA was an outgrowth of the law, and what the CIA was trying to do, and what the National Security Council was trying to do, and what the Congress was trying to do. And this eventually led to a remarkable statement by President Truman, I believe in December 1963, when he wrote as a columnist for a newspaper that the greatest mistake he made in his entire career as president was to sign the bill that created the Central Intelligence Agency.
Even though at the time it could be argued that he would not have seen the effect of his signing into law something which over time was changed by degree into something else.
Well, it's true that he never did sign the law that, I mean, the law he signed, if they had stayed within its parameters, the agency would have been much different. But he recognized that by setting this up, he initiated it.
I guess this perhaps is already explained by what you've just said, but perhaps just to comment briefly on this, you wrote on page 138 of The Secret Team that Congress had been so certain that the agency would not become operational and policy-making that it was content to place it under the control of a committee. Congress knew that the agency would never be permitted to become involved in clandestine operations, and therefore that the NSC would never have to direct it in an operational sense. How, at the time, do you feel Congress felt so unequivocal about this?
Well, you see, that's not a hard statement to understand in the time of the 1940s. It is today in the 80s or in the 70s or in the 60s. In the late 1940s, Congress and the congressmen who were, many of them, veterans of World War II, knew very well that the United States government was not going to have a covert operation, a covert establishment running around the world, and they had not even created a new major intelligence organization. Congress, in other words, believed the words of the law that it had just written and passed. Furthermore, we weren't in the buzzword period or the Pavlovian period of anti-communism at that time. It was coming, but it didn't exist then. Yeah. And we were sitting on top of the atom bomb capability, which meant that we were the absolute power in the world. Things were so different in the late 40s that you can't take those statements without a lot of care and understanding and transpose them to either the 60s, the 70s, or 80s. It's just ridiculous. You have to read them in terms of the 40s. And that's a pretty true statement of the 40s. Mm-hmm. But, of course, you'd change it if you were writing it today. And I'm sure Congress' view of CIA today is nothing like that, you see. But that is an important commentary on what has changed. And what has changed really in the people's minds, but not really in the language of the law. The law, the same law exists. But it's people's minds that have changed. It's our concept of the world that has changed. And that's a very important statement.
Mm-hmm. You do describe in fairly multitude of examples Alan Dulles' ability to, in effect, subvert the watchdog role of the NSC, which was intended to prevent such things as the CIA carrying out clandestine operations, by such moves as engineering the creation of such subcommittees as the Special Group 5412/2 that effectively neutralized such oversight functions as were intended to be carried out under the authority of the Operations Coordinating Board. Now, you've just mentioned how the OCB originally was set up to, in effect, have some supposed authority given to it by the Secretaries of Defense and State, and then how Walter Beadle Smith, in late 1950, in a sense, regained that person's position as claiming it for himself, that person was directly under him. Can you explain somehow, particularly Dulles, who is so central to this, was able to redefine this watchdog role of the NSC over clandestine operations?
Okay, first of all, let me make a technical correction to your question. The OCB was the Operations Coordinating Board, which was a part of NSC by law. OCB was, intended to be a group of senior individuals, or it was a group of senior individuals who would follow the decisions made by the National Security Council and make sure that the bureaucracy carried them out. That was the function of the OCB, a different organization. The operations policy, OPC, the Operations Policy Committee,
right,
was the residual OSS organization that was under Frank Wisner, and an extremely distinct organization from OCB.
Okay.
The OPC had been created only without law. See, it came from World War II. It was a necessary function. It was like sweeping up things left on the floor after the war. We had to keep alive the records from the OSS, and it was agreed to put this organization only structurally within the State Department, but to control its chief by making the new Secretary of Defense and his counterpart, the Secretary of State, responsible for the leader of the organization, giving him some control that way. The budgetary function was minimal. It was just a matter of paying people, that's about all, and taking care of the records. A lot of people have misinterpreted the OPC, although when it gradually worked its way into the CIA under Beadle Smith, it did become dominant again. It became rather strong, and it became the main clandestine operations sector of the agency later, known as the Deputy Director of Plans, and that sort of thing. So I like to correct the two letters are somewhat similar, but the jobs are entirely different. Now we'll go back to Mr. Dulles and how he was able to circumvent the law. And really the best way is to say again that the report that he had written with Correa and with Jackson outlined his vision of how the CIA ought to be. He believed that. He thought that it ought to have a full intelligence powers, including secret intelligence, and that it ought to have the clandestine capability to carry out any operations directed by the National Security Council. Well, by the time, see, he thought that could be started in 49. But by the time he got to be the DCI, things hadn't worked that way. The CIA had been kept rather quiet. It was coordinating intelligence, and it was doing very little in the covert activities field. He felt that should change, but he didn't have any law to do it. So what he did is he would take a plan that they had made up because of some input from a foreign country or from one of his station chiefs around the world that was in response to some action. Well, then he'd go to the National Security Council. They didn't direct him to go to X country and do something. They were approving something that he felt he ought to do in response to an action that some of his operators, some of his agents had seen in a foreign country. And that device enabled him to create activities as though they were reaction, and most of the time they were, or responses. And so the NSC found itself not directing covert operations, but approving reactive covert operations. There's quite a bit of difference. But when you're doing that with an organization like the CIA, under an ambitious leader like Alan Dulles, it's pretty hard to tell the difference, because sometimes you can create a response by kicking somebody under the table and they pound you in the nose, then you point to your partner and say, look at that guy, just hit me. You didn't know you kicked him under the table. The best example, the absolute best example I know of that tactic was the Gulf of Tonkin incident. The North Vietnamese that came out in the vicinity of the destroyers, which the Navy now admits were never even hit by anything fired at them, probably not even fired at. But the why those North Vietnamese Komar ships, very high-speed ships, came out there was because they had been hit clandestinely. So that the first act was by our own forces, aided with South Vietnamese. Then when the North Vietnamese came out, they had been provoked. They did not initiate the attack. But in the discussion of that, both by President Johnson and in Congress, when they were discussing the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, they were only told that the attack had been made by the North Vietnamese upon our Navy without provocation. Mm-hmm. So you can control covert activities by using that same device, the kick under the table, and then you can say, hey, now look what happened in the Congo, or look what happened in Indonesia, or look what happened in Tibet. We've got to do something about it. This was the technique that Dulles was the master of working at, and he tried to have the agency ready to be responsive anywhere in the world. And of course he had to do it that way because there were no plans. They didn't sit here and say, well, here's what we see happening in such and such a country, and here's what we think ought to be done, and here's how the United States should get in there with a covert operation to perform this or that, you know. There was none of that. There was no planning shop. In fact, I've always thought, and I worked very closely with them, that one of the strangest devices they used was to call their covert operations the deputy director plans, because there were no plans. I worked with them intimately for 9 years. I never saw a single plan come out of the deputy director plans. And of course, they would simply smile and say, well, that's just our euphemism for covert operations. But it was a... they could have used some other word than plan, because that was... But this is how Dulles worked, you see, and he was very effective. And he had a lot of experience with OSS. And the other side of it is that his brother was the Secretary of State and the dominant vote in the National Security Council. I don't think this would have been the same if he had been an individual with, say, some either neutral or objective Secretary of State. It made quite a bit of difference under the Eisenhower era to have the two Dulles working together in the development of covert operations.
Mm-hmm. And therefore then this key revising of the word as specified in the law that the NSC would direct the CIA, and now that the agency was in effect to turn this into the NSC approving measures brought to it by the CIA.
Precisely. See, I remember one example out of 9 years' work when I knew that the NSC had directed the CIA to involve itself in something, and that was Tibet. When the Chinese communists started overrunning Tibet, it was the NSC that put the CIA into that operation. And I must confess that in all those years, 55 to 64, pretty active years, I never saw another one come by direction. They were all responsive and reactive operations to things where Mr. Dulles or people that followed him would go in to brief the NSC from their own papers and say, here's what's been happening in country A, we propose an operation to oppose that. That's why we got into what was called counterinsurgency. We countered the insurgency. Yeah. Almost everything we were doing was a reactive response. But that was the Dulles method. That was his characteristic.
I'd like to quote a part here regarding the intelligence community as a whole. You wrote that on page 141 of The Secret Team, over the years it has become customary to speak of the various intelligence organizations within the government as members of the community. This word is quite proper because there is little cohesion and homogeneity within this vast infrastructure which has cost so much and which performs so many varied and separate functions. The members of the community are the CIA, the Army, Navy, and Air Force as separate divisions, the Defense Intelligence Agency, the FBI, the Atomic Energy Commission, the State Department, and the National Security Agency. All are by law brought together by the Director of Central Intelligence, or DCI. His title is not the Director of the Central Intelligence Agency, although he does head that agency for the purpose of advising the NSC in matters concerning such intelligence activities of the government departments and agencies as relate to national security. That's directly from the National Security Act of 1947. This is the DCI's first duty as prescribed by law. He is to advise the NSC of the activities of the other departments and agencies. Could you discuss the importance of the fact that all of the above-listed members of the intelligence community, quote, are by law brought together by the Director of Central Intelligence, unquote, and the implications of such an all-encompassing position?
That's a good section to bring out for discussion, because the law established, created, didn't establish. Established means something else in government. The law created the CIA to coordinate intelligence of the other branch of the government, as I listed them there. And the law specifically deals with the function of the Director of Central Intelligence. He is different from his organization. He is the Director of Intelligence over the other intelligence organizations within the scope of the law that establish him. He's not their boss in a sense that the Navy intelligence operates for the CNO, for the Chief of the Navy. But as far as intelligence matters are concerned, and as far as coordinating intelligence matters, he's the director for the coordinating purposes. It's quite a clear distinction, but you can see it does get waffled around. And certain of the intelligence assets of various departments, we'll say the Navy, are very independent. Navy's intelligence organization goes way back to Revolutionary War days. They are an excellent professional organization, and they're worldwide, and they're very powerful and very able. They were not subverting themselves to any new boss. They knew their job, and they made that clear when the law was being written. In fact, they protested the law more than anybody else. The Army has its own black intelligence, very deep intelligence, in many ways deeper than the CIA has ever learned how to do. They were not going to fold that into the CIA either. The Air Force was brand new, excuse me, had no intelligence other than experience as part of the Army. However, the Air Force had the aircraft, the U-2, the SR-71, the bombers and the camera plane, all the reconnaissance planes. They had the methods of intelligence that they could use that the DCI needed for coordinating also. So the Air Force, although it was new, in some ways, was probably more important than the other branches. So you see what I'm saying is that this intelligence community, which the law was created to bring together, was not homogenous, but they were essential to each other. No more than, say, the National Security Agency. Just think what any of these would be without the National Security Agency. They all depend upon the National Security Agency for the intercept of electronic transmission and all the other things, communications intelligence and all the rest. Well, the National Security Agency is a function of the Department of Defense. In fact, the office where I used to be assigned was responsible for directing the National Security Agency in order that we could coordinate it with state and CIA and the others ourselves to make sure it was effective. A very nice way to do this thing, and it was important in those days. So there is an intelligence community of great importance and great significance to each one of its components. But the sole chief of that community by law is the Director of Central Intelligence in the role that he's coordinating. No more than that. He doesn't direct these people in a clandestine exercise, not at all. Then he's the Director of Central, then he is the head of the CIA, and then he carries out things that are assigned to the CIA. So I'm sorry, it's quite clear how that works, although I'm afraid historically there are many, many abuses and a lot of times oversights in that, primarily because many of these agencies and departments have very parochial interests of their own, and it's pretty hard for anybody to coordinate them.
Mm-hmm. You, in the Law for Powers and Duties under National Security Act, Section 3, it says to correlate and evaluate intelligence relating to the national security. What about, just going through very briefly, examining or discussing the stated or explicit role of each of these members, as well as any important unstated roles that they carry out today? Let's start out with the CIA, at least in terms of the way it should work, which may vary a lot from the way it does.
You know, that's a excellent way to put the question, because it's impossible to answer that. You see, as we've been talking about, the law was written in 46 and 47 at an era that we cannot duplicate today at all. So I would just say right off that it would be futile to try to enforce the law literally on either the Defense Department or the CIA. There's no way you could, or the State Department. Mm-hmm. However, you have to abide by the law, see? And so you, at that point, you begin to let, you might say, the law of custom step in. What have we been doing? What have we accepted? So today, I don't think you could ever press back into the bottle what was decided in 46 and 47 and say, that's what the CIA is going to do. There's just no way you could do that. And I don't know how to prescribe for the CIA what it ought to be doing today by thinking about the law. But there's one part of the law that can take care of this. And this was one of the really beautiful things about that law. And that is that no matter what the CIA wants to do or tries to do or is funded to do, a very important statement of that, funded to do, because Congress permits the CIA to do an awful lot by pouring money into the CIA. If you got money, you're going to spend it. You know, Parkinson's law. If you build an office and you put a man in the office, he's going to go to work whether you tell him or not. So you fund CIA and you're going to get things done. Well, in the present time, under that situation, this emphasizes the great significance of the National Security Council. Now, this, what we've been talking about, emphasizes the very great importance of the National Security Council. If the President, the Vice President, the Secretary of State, and the Secretary of Defense can't handle the CIA, nobody can. Mm-hmm. And if they permit the funding from Congress or any other really covert work to put CIA into areas that they didn't approve, it's their fault. Nobody else's. This is one of the serious things about this recent Iran thing, that it seems as though Congress wants to accept the fact that Poindexter, McFarland, North, and all those men were doing things that the NSC didn't approve. And they are legitimizing that, which is terrible. You know, really, for the future, is a terrible thing to put up with. We've got a law that says if you're going to get into clandestine operations, it can only be done at the direction of the National Security Council. Yeah. And here we have the men who were members of the National Security Council, Reagan, Bush, Weinberger, and Shultz, all walking off and saying we had nothing to do with it. Now that, for the next era, is an enormous problem. And if Congress doesn't recognize what's happening, they better do it pretty soon, because they're going to find covert things going on that nobody knows anything about. Because what they are doing then is regularizing what I said in my book, that there exists a secret team that's out of control. Mm-hmm. And now they have regularized that, you see. That's the danger. If they don't keep the National Security Council over these organizations, they'll never get the genie back in the bottle.
Which is so curious, since you heard such a hue and cry during the hearings in the summer of 87 regarding that they're trying to take too much power away from the executive. The president needs to have more power here in these operations, when in fact he already had the power with the NSC.
And he denies he used it. See, right. The president's had nothing to do with what those fellows were doing. Mr. Bush, even today, is saying, I didn't do anything down in Honduras, or I didn't do anything when I met with the Israelis, or the, you know. It's appalling, because if they're going to accept that, they're denying the role of the National Security Council, and then they're permitting almost anybody else in the government to run covert operations. Yeah. Now, that's something else people need to understand about covert operations. We talk about the CIA being in charge of covert operations. Almost any branch of the government gets into covert operations, and they do it in a team fashion. That's why I called it the secret team, because I saw just as many people working in covert operations in Customs Service, in the Treasury Service, even in FAA sometimes, as I did when we saw CIA people and defense people working. It just depends on what type of operation you're in or who wants it done. Okay. It's not the CIA all the time, although they all get together and say it was the CIA. The CIA might have just had a representative in there. Or the CIA would provide its special communications and its other facilities that he had, that they have. As we heard in the case of Ollie North and the others, they had these special communications devices and all that. But other people were doing the jobs, you see. So we have to learn a lot more about how these things are done. But if we deny the role of the National Security Council, we're going to be in very, very deep trouble. There'll be nobody in no one in charge at all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A very central point, it seems, in the Secret Team book was your qualifying people who were working either within the military or then in a position, say, inside the Central Intelligence Agency. Could you please, regarding this term military, clarify the use throughout this book of the four examples of different types of military personnel you define?
Well, now, in ordinary agency business, there's a need for close relationship between the agency and the military departments. So hundreds of experienced intelligence officers are assigned to work with the CIA. The distinction is they're paid by their service. They are under the control of their service commanders. But they sit in a CIA office and work with the CIA for the purpose of coordinating intelligence. They bring to the CIA certain assets that it doesn't have, and the CIA exposes to them certain assets, so they work together. That's one thing. The next thing, there are certain military officers that the CIA needs to have for its own purposes. Let's say pilots, all right, as one career field, helicopter pilots or aircraft pilots, so on. So the CIA will pay the Department of Defense for, say, 100 pilots who will be assigned to CIA. The CIA reimburses the Department of Defense for those men, and strictly speaking, they work as employees of the CIA. The Defense Department, if it wishes, could hire 100 more pilots within its limits, you see, because it has this money from the CIA. Now, in every case of that, by the way, the man who is assigned is a volunteer. He doesn't have to go. He's not being assigned by the military. He's accepting an offer from the CIA. What we do is we keep dual records because we don't want to penalize either his military service or his retirement benefits and all that. He's still a government employee. And this is a very technical area we start getting into there, but that's a second use. You see, they take these people over there as they do people from agriculture or as they do from FAA. They mm-hmm. need certain other assets, which they pay for. Mm-hmm. Then we have an extensive group of people in the reserve. They can be called to active duty. They can be employed as civilians by CIA, and then with the permission of the Defense Department, called to active duty. Mm. And of course, they're paid for by the CIA. They work for the CIA. They're CIA employees. But only in certain jobs are they permitted, by agreement with the Defense Department, to put on their uniforms, carry defense ID, and work, maybe in a friendly country or maybe in a marginal country. Like we have organizations in Athens, in Australia, in many countries around the world, where military officers are assigned, but the CIA is using their capability. So there's a third group. And I think if we would go another step further, there are certain, this is a pretty rare case, but it existed, certain CIA men who have to be assigned to certain countries for specific duties, but there's no way the CIA can tell that country, look, I'm sending you a CIA agent. They sometimes say this is a man is with the State Department, a Foreign Service officer, but very frequently would say this man is a military officer. And with the approval, with the cognizance of the Defense Department, they take just Mr. X and call him Commander Jones. Mm-hmm. And he's made him a Navy commander and everything, and ostensibly he's a Navy commander. And he's never been on the military roles before, but he works for CIA. So you can have those four different roles simultaneously, and they exist in large numbers, thousands. During my day, I think we had over 5,000 people in these various categories. And they're effective around the world. In fact, I can remember a meeting when President Diem in Saigon said, you know, I have a real problem here. He says, I have all these generals who are military generals, but I find out they're really CIA. How do I know who's CIA? You know, and of course, in his country, there were more CIA generals than there were military generals. So he had a right to the question. Well, the same has happened in other countries, but usually it's kept pretty quiet, and the people are there for specific jobs. There are not generally abuses of the situation. We know what's going on, and at least in the days when I was intimate with this situation, we were kept very well informed in the Defense Department about these. We knew these agreements existed, and the people were taken very care of very carefully, and we kept it on the books under the regulatory base of reimbursement. We made them pay us money for these people when they were our military people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Stepping back for a minute to this idea of the shift in government policy after World War II from offense to defense, you spoke on page 126 to 127 about this in terms of the positive action that war, the idea of war, had held in the past. Quoting from the book here, you write, "What began perhaps as an honest effort to alert this country to the fact that the Soviet government did in fact have the potential to unleash the secrets of the atom, and thus to build atomic bombs, gradually became a powerful tool in the hands of the irresponsible and the agitators. The first great fault with the drift of opinion at that time became evident in the very shift of emphasis with regard to the national military establishment. Throughout our history, the idea of war had been treated as a positive action. War was the last resort of a nation, after all means of diplomacy had failed, to impress its might and its will upon another. And throughout our proud history, we never had faced war as something passive or reactive. But somehow in that post-war era, this nation began to think of war as defense alone. In other words, in this defense philosophy, we were not telling the world that the most powerful nation in the world was showing its magnanimity and restraint. We were saying that we would defend only. And to the rest of the world, that meant we were going to play a passive role in world affairs, and that we were passing the active role, and with it the initiative, to others, in this case to the men in the Kremlin. We not only said this as we disestablished our traditional War Department, but we have done it throughout the intervening 25 years by developing the capability to search out the action of an enemy and then by responding. This defensive posture of our military and foreign policy has been a terrible mistake, and it opened the doors for the newborn intelligence community to move in and take over the control of U.S. foreign and military policy." Just briefly, could you discuss the idea stated above that throughout our history, the idea of war has been a positive action?
I think that, you know, that's a powerful concept, and we have to talk about that. To have the greatest and most powerful nation on Earth, and in the 40s, when we dominated power because we were the only ones with the atom bomb, and the only ones with the means to deliver the atom bomb effectively all over the world, we all of a sudden went into this guise of defense when we talked about our military. A clear example of it, during the Vietnam War, General Westmoreland's goals were search and destroy.
Right.
Search, you're looking for something, and if you find it, you destroy it. It isn't destroy, you know, it isn't attack. He wasn't on the offense. He was looking for something to shoot at, you know, to destroy as a defensive mechanism. It affected even what I would call small wars that way. We were on the defense. He had no objective in Vietnam. He had no place to go in Vietnam and win the war. I've said in earlier elements of this discussion with you that the first officer I reported to the first day of my military duty, sometime in July 1941, happened to be a captain named Creighton W. Abrams, who became Chief of Staff of the Army and head of our forces in Vietnam after Westmoreland. I know from friends of mine, I've known General Abrams all my life, he's from my hometown, and I know from friends of mine who were with him that when President Johnson told him that he was going to be the commander in Vietnam, that he rather casually turned to the, well, the president had said, Johnson, with his gung-ho attitude, said, now, Abe, you've got 550,000 men in the Army out there. All you need to do the job. You've got the strongest Navy assembled in the world, the 7th Fleet. And you've got an Air Force that has delivered more bombs than in all of World War II. Now, by God, Abe, go out and do it. And I've been told that Abrams or one of his immediate staff turned to the president and said, Mr. President, would you want to define the word it for us? What is it that if we do it, we'll win that war from your position as our commander-in-chief? The president put his arm around Abrams' shoulder and led him to the door and sent him to Saigon. There was no it in the Vietnam War. That was the problem. When General Krulak, the very able Marine commander, became chief of all Marines in the Pacific, he devised a war plan that would move the forces forward, strongly fortified with native forces, people that were imbued with the idea of fighting for their country, to march on Hanoi and take over that and end the war. He could not get approval for that plan from the president and from Averell Harriman, who at that time was serving as the assistant Secretary of State for Far East Affairs. In other words, all the military agreed, the Chief of Chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mr. McNamara, the Commandant of the Marine Corps, CINC-PAC, Admiral Sharp, all the military agreed with his plan. They knew it was the way to do it. But Averell Harriman, a civilian, and President Johnson, a civilian, imbued with the idea of we're on the defense, couldn't see that, and they denied General Krulak the permission or the direction to go and do it, just what President Johnson wanted them to do. Well, that's making an example out of the statements, but you see, that's what happens. Warfare, probably best defined by Clausewitz, is an all-out action of a certain country. It is total action. It's not halfway, it's not divided, it's not graduated, it's total. Well, you can't make total defense. You have to make total offense, even if you're in a defensive position. If you're in a siege in a fort, you've been thinking about offense because you're thinking of getting out of there. You're going to die if you stay there, you see. Offense is the core of war. Clausewitz lists 9 principles of war that have been the same ever since men were throwing stones at each other, on up to atom bombs. The primary principle of war is the objective. If you don't know what you're doing, you got no business going to war. That is the antithesis of the idea of having a Department of Defense. And this is very important for our country. We don't know why we have a military. In fact, when President Reagan spoke about having weapons in space, he called it the Strategic Defense Initiative, putting two opposite words together, the initiative and the defense. Defense initiative. The words don't even go together. You know, it's like having a cat dog or something, you know. You can't do it. Well, this is how bad the thinking about warfare has become in this country. And it isn't because people have become less able. It's because they are unable to assimilate the power and the threat of nuclear weapons. And today, the power and the threat of the biological weapons, such as AIDS. AIDS is a weapon, and don't forget it. It was developed by the Defense Department, and it's a weapon. And people need to know that, and they should never forget it. It is a biological weapon created by the Defense Department, funded by Congress. That's all a matter of record. It is not a disease that came out of some cellar somewhere by mistake. So, and this is why people don't know how to assimilate the idea of warfare. They don't know what to do with hydrogen bombs that can erase a whole city in seconds. And they don't know what to do with AIDS as a weapon. Mm-hmm. It gets away and they can't stop it. Well, that's the basic problem we're having today when we talk about warfare. We have forgotten how war is waged, and defense is not the way to wage a war.
How would you see an offensive, positive action-based war department operate in the world today?
Because of the power of weapons, including some that we only talk about and haven't used yet. There is no way to wage war. Man is too puny a beast to cope with hydrogen bombs. There's no way you can do it. You can destroy the Earth, but that's not winning a war. So when you ask me to define that, we can still fight. We can still make victory. We can still go on the offense. But we will do it economically.
Yeah.
And we are doing it economically. The first battle of the new kind of war was called the Arab oil embargo. We made the entire world pay tribute to the people who possess petroleum. And it's quite a battle. And it separates the winners and the losers, but that's the new battle. The second battle is being prepared, and it will be the battle over food. Yeah. And this blends in with the idea that increasingly we hear of Malthusianism. We are beginning to agree or to permit the concept of genocide because of too many people on Earth. Well, that fits in with this next battle that's coming up. Petroleum, in a sense, is a luxury. You can walk to work. You don't have to drive to work. But when the battle becomes the battle for food, there's no alternative. You have to have food. And this is, war still is on. See, people's minds are still, we're ready to fight. Terrorism is a function of this, but terrorism is not war. Terrorism is mosquitoes, and you kill mosquitoes if you can. But food becomes a weapon of war, and there's no way we can have a war anymore. War is done when you're talking about divisions, battleships, bombers, because of hydrogen bombs.
Right. Would there be any way through the thicket, in with the benefit of hindsight, that you would see possible such a form of a Department of Government having been retained and maintained in the years immediately after World War II, with all the accompanying pressures and transformations of that time? I suppose the answer would be no, because of the nuclear capabilities. Yeah. That
you see, the leading commanders immediately after Hiroshima had no trouble in seeing that if you replicated that around the world, you'd just do it until the world was ashes. Well, when the Russians perfected the hydrogen bomb, and remember, the Russians initiated the hydrogen bomb, perfected it first. We did it second. We could immediately, we knew they had exploded a weapon, a device, equal to about 50 megatons. And that device is so powerful that it not only destroys an enormous part of Earth puts radiation over a larger part, lethal radiation, but it actually blows a hole through the atmosphere above the Earth and goes on out into space somewhere. It's beyond control on Earth entirely. Mm-hmm. Well, our leaders recognized that as far back as 40s and early 50s. And you can see that ever since then, our presidents, including Eisenhower, could not visualize or even see the business of going to war anymore. The Korean War was just kind of a war game. When MacArthur really began to move, they called him back. The Vietnam War was even worse than that. There were no attacks, no moves anywhere. Anloa Valley, a very hostile area in the heart of the Vietnam, was captured 8 times by our forces. And once they captured it, they had no reason to keep it, so they walked away. And then it got hostile again, and we captured it. That's the way war is being fought. And war now is outmoded entirely. Huh. I don't think many people are ready to accept that. But if I were teaching evolution of warfare today at Yale University, I would put the closing chapter on war, and I would simply end with the explosion of the hydrogen bomb. And just say, there it is.
That's it.
Doesn't mean you can't fight and shoot people.
Right.
You know, we've got automatic rifles on the streets now. I mean, I'm not saying people aren't going to be killed, but we are not going to have a war between country A and country B effectively anymore if hydrogen weapons are involved. Iraq and Iran can fight to exhaustion. Notice they didn't go anywhere. They fought each other for, 6 or 7 years and didn't go anywhere, didn't do anything except kill each other. If either one had a nuclear weapon, they'd have had to end the war mutually because they couldn't live with them. You know, the end of it in their countries.
Yeah. Discuss the significance of, as you write, quote, the schism between those who believed in the traditional school of national planning and overt diplomacy
and those who believed in a passive role of reaction to a general enemy, or communism, unquote, that began after World War II, and how, quote, this latter school would operate in response to intelligence inputs without plans and without national objectives, would hide everything in secrecy, and would justify its actions in all instances as being anti-communist.
We've been talking a bit about that. That's very important. It used to be very interesting in the period of the 50s to go to SHAPE headquarters in Europe, ahead of the NATO forces, and to work with the war plans people there. I was in the plans division of Air Force, and although I was doing the clandestine work, I was immersed in the plans work day after day for years. And I would go to the war plan sections in NATO, and you could see that there was no war plan that called for a war like World War II. What I mean by that is an all-out war where you take a general like General Patton and say, destroy the German forces, bring the country to its knees, which he could do. In a modern war plan, if you want to destroy, we'll say, East Germany, you'd just push a few buttons and some rockets would fly over there and the nuclear weapons would fall and you say, what's next? You know, that's the facts. So it was interesting to see in this transition period of the 50s when some people began to realize that's where the position we were in and war plan had no place to go. And then over here, the people who were the officers that I described earlier working for the CIA who were saying, yes, but we need to fight communism and we can go in there and stop this insurgency, so we'll run a counterinsurgency program. And you know, it was the CIA that took the special forces who were designed to do post-strike work in a nuclear war and gradually moved special forces over into the civic action counterinsurgency side of the business. And they realized that if there was going to be any activity, they could promote that activity their way, you know, counterinsurgency type or covert operations, covered in secrecy and all that. But that's far removed from warfare. But it is a very lethal activity going all the way up to the Vietnam War. It can once you start a fire going, no telling how far it's going to burn. You just keep throwing more fuel on the flames and it'll burn.
There's a very philosophical edge at one point. You're discussing the manifestation of the Manichaean devil. Is that the correct way to pronounce that?
I believe it
Manichaean
is, yes.
Devil in the nuclear age. This is from page 226 and 27. Quoting, those who believed that our only road to salvation lay in greater stockpiling of atomic bombs, those who argued that it must be the hydrogen bomb, and those few who said that it must be both, all perhaps without common intent, began to create the idea of the enemy threat. It was coming. It was inevitable. The things that have been done since that period in the name of anti-enemy would make a list that in dollars alone would have paid for all the costs of civilization up to that time with money to spare. Such an enemy is not unknown. Man has feared this type of enemy before. It is human, and more than that, it is a social trait to dread the unknown enemy. This enemy is defined in one context as the Manichaean devil. Norbert Wiener says, quote, the Manichaean devil is an opponent, like any other opponent, who is determined on victory and will use any trick of craftiness or dissimulation to obtain this victory. In particular, he will keep his policy of confusion secret, and if we show any signs of beginning to discover his policy, he will change it in order to keep us in the dark, unquote. The great truth about this type of enemy is that he is stronger when he is imagined and feared than when he is real. One of man's greatest sources of fear is lack of information. To live effectively, one must have adequate information. It was in this great conflict that the National Security Act of 1947 was brewed, and man's demand for information pervaded and surmounted almost every other move he made. Thus a great machine was created. All of the resources of this country were poured into a single Department of Defense, defense against the great Manichaean devil which was looming up over the steppes of Russia, with the formula of the atomic bomb in the one hand and the policy of world communism in the other. Our statesmen foresaw the Russian detonation
of the atomic bomb in 1949, and the concurrent acceleration towards the hydrogen bomb as soon as thereafter as possible. So they created the Atomic Energy Commission in January of 1947, and then the Defense Department in September 1947, and gave both of them the eyes and ears of the CIA to provide the essential information that at that time was really the paramount and highest priority. The AEC was ordered to achieve both goals, the second-to-none atomic bomb stockpile and the hydrogen bomb, and the DOD was ordered to create the global force that would defend this country against the giant of the Soviet Union and all other nuclear powers. Discuss the significance of, quote, the transfer in January 1947 of the great nuclear weapon technology to the Atomic Energy Commission.
Well, we'll start with that final question because it's an important one. Atom bomb, as you know, was developed under the Manhattan Project, which was part of the Army during the war. It was obvious that at the end of the war, there would have to be a continuing development with atomic weapons, fission weapons, that there would also probably be peacetime use of these weapons, that the ability to manufacture these rare materials, plutonium and the like, for the weapons was an enormous facility and would have to be run by someone, and yet it was inadvisable to keep that in the Army. It was felt that this should be under national control, more or less like for coordination, almost like the CIA to coordinate all this. Mm-hmm. So they moved this business of the nuclear weapons into the Atomic Committee, AEC.
Energy Commission.
Yeah, and they continued the development of the fission weapon, which is, at the time they were dropped at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there were two different types and more or less competing with each other for perfection. So there was a lot of research still to do, and finally they got the atom bomb from a monster that you could put one in a B-29 down to where you could carry it around the back of a Volkswagen, you know, they improved it, and enlarged it also, and in due time created the hydrogen bomb, which now can be any size you want. You can make a hydrogen bomb as about big as you want. So this was put under the Atomic Energy Commission, as well as the development of nuclear power, and to a degree space materials and so on. That was a practical matter. The other side of this thing, the Manichaean devil, is just another way of talking about the Cold War.
Yeah.
You can't get Congress to appropriate money for an enormous war organization unless you can show a reason for it. Huh. And so we had to create the reason. We had to create this devil, and we created communism. Even the Soviets don't understand the communism we think about. It goes so far beyond. And we saw it in every closet, every country. We divided the entire world up into us and them. So then we began to create a military establishment that could counter, we thought, every move made by anybody. Every time India went a little bit pro-communist, India became our enemy. Every time India went a little bit toward us, and they became our friends. Well, everybody was in that area. They were pro. There were no neutrals. It was all us and them. Well, this has resulted in the expenditure of $6 trillion for armaments, most of which can never be used effectively. There is no way to use them effectively. Even in Vietnam, we dumped 2.5 times as much bombardment onto the ground in Vietnam as we did in all of World War II. To what effect? We killed a lot of people, we uprooted a lot of trees, and so on, but there was no really military effect of that. Well, that's the way the rest of our establishment is. They could have been hydrogen bombs. In fact, you know, we had nuclear weapons in Indochina. Fortunately, we didn't use them, but they were there. So, but on the other side of it, if you create this devil and he's in every closet around the world, then you can justify having a 600 fleet navy and a something or other wing air force and an enormous army, because you keep telling the Congress and the American people My goodness, this great, enormous devil is going to leap out of a closet any day, at any time. The war could start here or could start there. We've got to be ready for the whole world. And that's how you spend the money. Even though you can't prove what you're going to do with the money, you spend it. You see, the devil scares you so bad that you don't think anymore. Even the Strategic Defense Initiative, this thing that was going to cost billions and billions, now we spend for a B-2 bomber, which is supposed to be stealthy. And they claim that radar cannot find that bomber as it approaches. Heck, it makes more noise than almost anything you ever heard. It's got huge engines, and they're ducted out so that even the radar can't read the engine. But that doesn't mean it shuts the sound down. The first way we used to detect bombers coming during World War II was with noise devices. So they'll just go back to noise devices. Stealth bomber will be worthless. It's already worthless before it flies. And the most expensive airplane spent $65 billion on an airplane that can't get in the air yet. And when it does, all the enemy, you say, will have to do is, instead of use radar, use audio, listen for it. And they know it's there. So we don't even know what we're doing. So that's what this Manichaean devil does. And an interesting little sideline about Vietnam. The Vietnam escalation modestly began in the Kennedy era. And Kennedy was said to have around him the Irish Mafia. If you know much about the lore of old Ireland, you'll know that the Irish mother would tell her bothersome child, "If you aren't a good boy, the Kong will get you. The Kong will get you." The Kong was a ghost in the closet, see? Well, in Vietnam, the word for a beggar is a Kha, K-H-A. And they were briefing about these beggars, these troublemakers in Vietnam, and they were calling them the Viet Cong. Well, Kennedy's young Irish mafia men, who did not know much about Vietnam, thought they were talking about the Viet Cong, the devil in a closet. And the word Viet Cong was created by mistake, by hearing the word Ka as a Vietnamese word and Cong as the Irish ghost. And it just happened that in that era, we all of a sudden got Viet Cong out of the misapplication of the word right in an office in the Pentagon of Washington and not out in the field in Vietnam. Ever after that, it was the Viet Cong. Well, that's how we create our Manichaean devils. That's how we create our opposition. That's how we spend $6 trillion.
You write further on, concerning the realization of the Dulles Jackson Korea's report's method of placing CIA agents throughout the government, quote, "Many of these people who have reached positions of great responsibility, I believe that the most powerful and certainly the most useful agent the CIA has ever had operates in just such a capacity within another branch of the government, and he has been there for so long that few have any idea that he is a long-term career agent of the CIA. Through his most excellent and skillful services, more CIA operations have been enabled to take place than can be laid at the feet of the agency, at the feet of any other more legitimate agent. This was the plan and the wisdom of the Dulles idea from the beginning. On the basis of security, he would place people in all areas of the government, and then he would move them up and deeper into their cover jobs, until they began to take a very active part in the role of their own organizations. This is how the ST was born, the secret team. Today, the role of the CIA is performed by an ad hoc organization that is much greater in size, strength, and resources than the CIA has ever been visualized to be." So the first question I have here would be, how, quote, "on the basis of security," unquote, would Alan Dulles, quote, "place people in all other areas of the government?"
Well, one of the first things that I realized was that it was Mr. Dulles' desire to have the office that General White asked me to create in the Air Force headquarters in order to create a focal point system. And as Mr. Dulles told me later, he said, "I don't want various people from my agency going into the Pentagon and dealing with different people there, and therefore uncovering the activities of the CIA to a large number of people, because obviously such a ring would then proliferate to others, and if they wanted submarines, they'd have to bring in some Navy people, and if they wanted helicopters, they'd have to talk to some Army people. He said, I want a focal point. I want an office that's cleared to do what we have to have done, an office that knows us very, very well, and then an office has access to a system in the Pentagon, but the system will not be aware of what initiated the request. They'll think it came from the Secretary of Defense. They won't realize it came from the Director of Central Intelligence. So you see, the Dulles philosophy was to control the focal point area. This led then to the creation of focal point offices everywhere. And as I established this Tab 6 organization, we called it, in every major staff area within the Air Force, because that was my jurisdiction at the time, I would have cleared people, another focal point, you might say a sub-focal point, a person I could go to who had been given ahead of time the authority to do whatever it was that he was authorized to do. And we stressed that authorized business. He would have to be sure he had orders either from my office or directly up to the chief of staff, and that we knew what we were doing for CIA. Well, this leads to another step you might call breeding. We had to work with various agencies of the government, not just the Defense Department. We had to have contact points in the State Department, in the FAA, in the Customs Service, in the Treasury, in the FBI, and all around through the government, up in the White House. And gradually we wove a network of people who understood the symbols and the code names and the things we were doing and how we handled money, which was the most important thing. And then we began to assign people there who those agencies thought were from the Defense Department, but they actually were people that we put there from the CIA. This led to the creation of a system of powerful individuals, people whose jobs were quite dominant in some of these other agencies, especially after they'd been there 2 or 3 years, because we put them in there by talking to the top man, the cabinet officer or the head of the agency, and we'd say, this man is being placed here so that he can facilitate covert activities and so that he can retain the secrecy that's required, and he will keep you informed at all time. Well, in the bureaucracy, the top people move faster than anybody else, not the bottom people. And so the man we had explained that to maybe a year and a half earlier would be transferred or leave the government, but our man is still there. So 1 or 2 cycles of that, and that agency might not even know that guy was there anymore. What his origins were, they would think he was just another one of their own employees. And as a result, he became extremely effective, because if we wanted something done, I remember a rather very, very sensitive operation that I needed some information on, and I needed it from the FBI. I didn't go to the FBI. I went to this guy that we had planted, and he got it twice as fast and in a much better form than I would have gotten from the FBI, even though I was at that time working from the Office of Secretary of Defense. We had no trouble working with the FBI. It was just to facilitate it. Yeah. These people became very, very adept. By the same token, people that were employees of CIA agents were assigned even in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. We had certain people there who were CIA employees. Ed Lansdale worked for CIA all his adult career. A person named Frank Hand worked there. Now, the people in the Pentagon thought they were ordinary military employees. They didn't realize. Well, just to give you an example, Colonel Lansdale was a full colonel in the Air Force. That was his cover story. And he had been a full colonel for a few years. And the Air Force was promoting some men to general. Question came up, would Lansdale be eligible? And I told Mr. Dulles personally, I said, you know, you can make Lansdale a general if you just write a letter to General LeMay, because you're going to pay the bills anyway, and not the Air Force. A few days later, I got a call from General May's office. He called me in, and he had the list of men that the Air Force was promoting to general. And as I recall, it was only 13 or 14 officers, and LeMay, being General LeMay, knew every one of them intimately, except one. He said, Prouty, he said, I understand you know who this guy Lansdale is. I don't know who the hell he is. I'm not going to promote him to a general. And I said, well, don't you have a file on him? He said, yes. He opened it up, and the top letter was from Allen Dulles. I said, he's a very important man for Allen Dulles. It's okay, I'll promote him. Just like that. Well, that's a good way to get a promotion, you see. But that created a very important job within the structure of the Office of Secretary of Defense. Frank Hand had been there for years in the same way. Frank was a civilian of, I always wrote that he was the most important agent that the agency had, because he was operating daily and effectively as a member of the Office of Secretary of Defense. And you can think of the things that a person in that capacity can do when his home base really is CIA. Well, although people didn't believe this when they first heard it, there are assignments like that in the White House. There are assignments like that in the State Department. It's hard to tell the difference, you might say, between Bill Bundy, who was a longtime CIA employee, and McGeorge Bundy, who was in the White House with Kennedy. The two brothers certainly going to act side by side. They have the same goals and the same intentions. Well, there were many things that duplicated like that. So that it wasn't long before, and I'd say by the end of the 50s, early 60s, before we had spread through the government what I called a secret team, a group of people who really knew how to operate the CIA business.